Blog Talk Radio.
This is Movie Geeks United. Thank you all for joining us. Jerry, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. And you'll forgive me for the delay into your intro there. I didn't know that you were going to go to me immediately. But since you did, that's cool. Welcome to our show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a great show for you tonight. We have a great guest, and then we're going to talk a lot of BS as usual about the movie. So it should be a great time.
Yeah. The movies, by the way, I haven't been back to the theater since I saw Ghost Rider last weekend, but I did see a couple of very interesting movies at home this week.
Don McKay, which has been, you know, and I think you should talk about that because I didn't, you know, I went to look for that after you wrote that thing on Facebook last night. It's still not available on DVD, so.
Right. It gets released like April 2nd, I think, and it gets released soon. I don't have the exact date on me, but
yeah, but it sounds fascinating.
We, like last year, we interviewed a couple of people from this film, Emmett Walsh and James Rebhorn.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're working on Thomas Hayden Church and Elizabeth Shue next week from it. And it is really insane, this movie. And to say too much about it would be giving too much away, too much of that unique experience away. It's kind of like a film noir, and it takes really, really exceptionally surprising, very odd turns. It's the oddest movie I've seen in a long time.
Well, that's good. I always take that as a good sign if it's, you know.
It's very different, yeah. So be on the lookout for that, and we'll be talking about that movie more with some upcoming interviews that we're going to do. But also the I saw the movie that we'll be discussing tonight with the talents we have, Handsome Harry, which was phenomenal.
It's got a great cast. I mean,
it does, yeah. And it's so another surprising film. You don't know where it's going, and it ends up being a surprisingly kind of tender, emotional movie.
Mm-hmm.
That I think a lot of audiences are going to connect with. And that opens up on the 16th of April in select cities, I believe. And then I saw a movie called Paper Man, which is a movie with Jeff Daniels and Ryan Reynolds and Lisa Kudrow, which was also very eccentric. I mean, I've been watching.
Can I ask you a question? Because this has been on sort of like on my mind for like the last decade. When you mean eccentric, or do you mean quirky, or do you mean eccentric? And I mean, because I hate the Q word gets on my nerves after a while.
I know the Q word gets on your nerves.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess I use the word eccentric because quirky is so overused. But
it is. It seems to be the be-all, end-all to describe anything that's not like a studio film the last couple
really,
of
what I'm saying is there are just as many bad independent films as Hollywood films. But some independent films are just run of the mill. The bad ones are bad for the same reasons the Hollywood films are bad.
Right, right.
These three films are truly independent. They have a very independent mindset. They stand out from the pack. They're unafraid to take chances.
Okay,
and,
that's good.
Yeah.
I just have to ask that because quirky is used. It's almost in the last. I want to say, you know, especially in the last 5 years. Quirky is like the most unoriginal word you can use to describe a movie that's offbeat. They just throw quirky on it. They show quirky on an actress or an actor or a director.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for, you know, in the 90s, we would have said, okay, that's interesting. But in this decade, or in the decade that just ended, it's just like, well, it's almost derogatory at this point.
Well, and something like Don McKay is definitely out there. But
right.
it's so committed to that it does the quote-unquote quirkiness doesn't feel like a device.
Right, right.
It feels like part of the fiber of the film. So, and we could all use more fiber.
We'll always use more fiber.
So, what movies have you seen this weekend?
I have seen Hot Tub Time Machine, which I thought was very funny. And I've noticed there's kind of a generational rift with this film. I think a lot of the younger kids don't get the humor, but for those of us who grew up in the time period where this takes place, the central action takes place, it's very funny. I have to say this, though. It's the Craig Robinson and Rob Corddry breakout film.
Mm-hmm.
For them, for both of them, especially Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, or used to be on The Daily Show, he's phenomenal in it. I really enjoyed it. I don't know if it's like this year's Hangover or not. I know there's a lot of people who thought it would be. And I know given the box office results, when you're going against two 3D family films, it's not going to be the case. But I actually found that there's something very sweet about the film.
Okay. That's what I was
really
going to ask, because I heard that there was... That it turned out, you know, it has that formula that combines the gross out and the raunchiness with the touchy feely kind of elements.
Oh, that's perfect. That you described it perfectly, because the third act of the film is totally that. And if you're willing to buy into to what the story is and you watch it, I mean. I had a friend of mine, a good friend of the show, Lana, who's been a supporter of ours for years, said she felt like she was watching the sequel to Better Off Dead. That's not so off the mark, given the scheme, backdrop, and giving John Cusack and everything. That's
okay.
Let
me ask this question.
Oh, shit.
Is John Cusack suffering a breakup at all in this movie?
Oh, yes.
Okay. This is interesting about John Cusack, and I like him. He's a likable presence, but
right.
In terms of range, he's probably the 40-year-old Robert Redford. But in terms of like range of choices, he tends to choose like the same character. Whatever
he's doing. 2012.
Well, yeah. Here's a sampling. High Fidelity.
Yeah.
He starts the movie. He's dumped by his girlfriend. America's Sweethearts. He's going through a marriage breakdown. Ice Harvest.
Mm-hmm.
He's recently divorced.
Yeah.
Grace is gone. He's widowed.
Yeah.
1408, he's estranged from his wife. Martian Child, he's widowed. War, Inc., his wife has been murdered. 2012, he's got marital problems. The Contract, he's widowed in The Contract.
Yeah. No, you bring up a very good point, because I was thinking about this, because I was thinking of, you know, John Cusack, with the exception, I think, of The Grifters.
And City Hall. Yeah.
And City Hall. He is really, you know, a lot of people give certain actresses this hard time about playing the same part. I love John Cusack. I think he's incredible. But you bring up an awesome point. He is playing a variation of the same part over and over and over again. And it's very true. You know, because that's all I could think of while watching. I'm like, okay, wait a second. Now, either this is the John Cusack career retrospective, or this is the... you know, he's playing the same part. I mean, and he does it so well, but I would love to see more parts like The Grifters. I don't think that's an unfair thing, but you're absolutely right, Jamie. It was going through my mind throughout the film. I was like, wow.
I'd love to see more movies like The Grifters, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see more films like The Grifters.
Yeah, so Hot Tub Time Machine, it didn't do so hot, but it had some different competition.
Question, because this is actually important to bring up in the last week. A film like Hot Tub Time Machine, and the big thing, I guess, last week was the raising prices of the 3D films, and you have these two 3D films. Can anything really compete with these family-friendly 3D films?
No, I wasn't looking for it to beat the family friendly
film.
But I think even given that criteria, the the industry probably was looking for another, you know, $10 million on the gross for Hot Tub.
Yeah, it's like with She's Out of My League. I think in another, you know, funny film, not a great film, nothing that I, you know, I put on a mantelpiece, but still an enjoyable film. I don't, you know, for every Hangover, for every Old School, there are these other films that are good, but just, you know, like, all right, let's take, for example, The Goods, which is a funny film, not a, I don't think a particularly great film, but it comes on the heel, right on the heels of The Hangover. And I think people just, after a while, they get, I don't know how much the raunchiness.
They get hungover.
What? Well, they're hungover. But remember, look at something like Bruno. Bruno really comes right after the heels of The Hangover. Mm-hmm. And that didn't light the screen on fire like a lot of people thought it would.
Right.
So.
Well, some other big news from this past week. On Friday, Dennis Hopper accepted his star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which was a point of fascination with movie fans and the media because Dennis Hopper, it's been said, you know, days previous that he's on his deathbed, essentially. I mean, I'm reading what came out of his lawyer's mouth, that he's nearing the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He can't maintain a conversation for more than an hour without getting exhausted. This is what his lawyer said in court because he's going through his divorce proceedings. So this legend of the 60s counterculture and this gigantic performances in our generation with Hoosiers and Blue Velvet,
right?
Alone, I mean that back to back combo. What can you say about it other than
great. I am very. No, because my mom was telling me about this. He can't go to the. He couldn't go to the ceremony, but we've been reading about this for the last couple of months, and it doesn't. That movie he did with Ben Kingsley and Penelope Cruz.
Yes.
Elegy was like sort of this horrible foreshadowing, but.
And he's great in that. And he did go to the ceremony. He attended it.
Oh, he did. Okay, no, I was told he didn't. Okay, well, there you have.
I'm
corrected on the air, folks. So
he made a little speech, and he.
Okay, good. Good.
Viggo Mortensen presented it to him, and you know, it was something that his doctor said, yes, you can go.
Okay, no, that's good. No, I'm glad to know that. I have to say this about Dennis Hopper, because I've always grown up with the specter of Dennis Hopper in movies like that. He directed Out of the Blue, the last movie. But I'll never forget the first time I watched Giant in its entirety in 1990. And he's so normal, and he's so... You know, he's the son that wants to, you know, he of course wants to marry the girl who's, you know, not in the same socioeconomic class as his parents would expect him to. And he's so mellow in that film, and it's a beautiful performance. It's just, you know, because I had been raised on the Dennis Hopper of Easy Rider, Apocalypse Now, and Blue Velvet. And then I watched Giant, and not that I had a negative view of Dennis Hopper, but it made me appreciate his range so much further.
Yeah, and something like what you said, Elegy. It's such a like tender performance,
mm-hmm.
and he's got just the most jaw-dropping moment.
Oh, he does.
In the whole movie, when he goes to kiss Ben Kingsley.
Mm-hmm.
Those are moments, and he's part of the history of movies, the
mm-hmm.
history of a cultural revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember in Apocalypse Now, in that scene where Marlon Brando throws something at him, he's really throwing that at him because he hates Dennis Hopper with passion, because Dennis Hopper really hated Marlon Brando because Brando badmouthed James Dean so much. So there was this animosity going on between the two of them on the set of that film. That's where Coppola, another thing that Coppola really didn't need going on that film, but it added to those scenes. I mean, when Hopper comes out and gives that little, in those 2 or 3 minutes, I think he sums up Kurtz's, the essential meaning of Kurtz's existence, actually. in that.
Right.
Well, the first time you watch it, it's like, you know, scatterbrain crazy, but the more you analyze it, it's like, wow, the photojournalist is one of the most competent characters in the whole film. And I Hopper's role in that is brilliant. I know a lot of people like to say Blue Velvet or this and that, but I think his role in Apocalypse Now is nothing short of brilliant.
Well, I think he's great in that. I think Blue Velvet really, in terms of a comeback performance.
Yes, it is. And for Stockwell,
I mean,
too.
Yeah. Well, Hopper, man. Hopper.
Yeah, I mean,
went for it. And then when he goes from that psychotic nitric oxide sucking rapist, he goes to something like Hoosiers, which is such a deeply felt, and it felt autobiographical,
mm-hmm.
in a way for him, that he was bringing a lot of stuff to that.
Right.
Yeah. So, Oliver Stone, Wall Street 2.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking last week or so about the move to September for the movie from its original April release date, and their excuse being Cannes. And of course, anything having to do with Oliver Stone, there has to be a conspiracy wrapped around it. So they asked Oliver Stone about a possible conspiracy involving this switch. He said, this is the flat-out truth. He said, Fox said, we'd like this movie for April. We'd finish shooting principal photography on December 9th. That's a tight squeeze, but I could have made it. But then the possibility of Cannes arose, which Oliver Stone thought was a great platform. And also the studio was scared about Wall Street 2 being disturbingly close to the May 7th opening of Iron Man 2.
Mm.
So in terms of the magazine coverage, since Michael Douglas had the Vanity Fair cover and Shia LaBeouf had something else, he told them, well, if you want to do the covers, we might not come out in April. So,
right.
Whether or not you do the covers is completely up to you. It's a crapshoot.
Right.
So, no conspiracy.
No.
It sounds legitimate.
It sounds legitimate. I think they have something there. You know, this is a big property. It is a big sequel. It is a sequel. I don't know if you'd say it like in The Two Jakes or The Godfather 3 mode, but it is a big sequel to a very popular film from, you know, our teen years. I'm very curious to see how it plays out. I'm very curious, you know, how does Gordon Gekko exist in present-day America? That's a very fascinating concept, and I hope that since they have delayed it, they're doing the best they can to tweak this to really give us, I think, a really awesome film, because I'm very curious to see how Gordon Gekko exists. Because
mm-hmm.
he's a fascinating character from my high school years. And I've told you this many times before, I think that film was misunderstood by many of our peers. They took the wrong lessons from that film. Everyone wanted to be like Gordon Gekko or the Charlie Sheen character, but no one understand the ramifications of that.
Yeah. At the Movies.
Oh, this is very sad.
Yeah, it has been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
They were hoping, I'm sure, with Michael Phillips and who's the other person?
A.O. Scott.
A.O. Scott. Two very intellectual critics, that it would see a rebirth, but I guess they're not happy enough with the ratings. So they've canceled it. This is the last season of At the Movies.
Right.
Damn that Disney.
Yeah, well, it's sad. It's sad because these are two very good critics. These are two critics that I read on a regular basis, and it is sad. You know, this last week was not a great week for film criticism, because while you had this drama playing out, you had a much bigger drama playing out on Twitter. And
with what?
Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith had a nervous breakdown on Twitter. And
yeah.
I don't know whether you want to talk about this or not, but I've been thinking about this a lot lately, because at first I thought, okay, he's taking on his critics for cop-out. Okay. The more you think about this, the more you realize, of all the films in your resume, you want to defend Cop Out. That's a bad move.
Right.
And he went ahead and then just basically sort of pissed on the very people that championed him. And the thing you have to say, I could understand if he did this for Zach and Marie. I could understand if he did this for Clerks, too. I might even understand it for Jersey Girl. But Cop Out, which the title just alone is, I can't believe he did.
It's very ironic.
Think about the title. But he really sort of, you know, someone described it as a spoiled child's tantrum. But he really went out and insulted a lot of the people who championed him. He basically the bottom line was that if you had to pay for the movie, you would be kinder for it as opposed to the critics who get in for free.
Mm.
And which is the logic behind this is mind-boggling. But as a lot of people pointed out, look, we paid for it and we didn't like it. The best thing I read was that if Kevin Smith had spent more time on the script instead of Twittering, it might have been good.
Yeah, and I think if you go and pay for it, you're probably harsher on the movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a mediocre movie. It's not the worst movie I've ever seen. You have to have real talent to make a really, truly horrible movie. It's a mediocrity.
Yeah.
I like Kevin Smith. I like him a lot. But I have to say, this film, you wanted to do something as a director for hire. Okay, you did it. It's not great. You've even admitted this is not one of your best films. Why you would pull this stunt and this? I don't understand why I would just let this film die and work on the next film that everyone's looking forward to.
First of all, he doesn't make films that live or die by critical. Response.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to see Cop Out, you're going to see it because you want to see a Bruce Willis movie.
Yeah.
Apparently, people didn't want to see this one.
No one.
But they didn't want to see The Surrogates either. There were a couple of recent Bruce Willis movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad that, I mean, this is just I love Bruce Willis, but the last couple films have been incredibly bad. But this film is, how do I say it? I think Kevin Smith, he really just sort of, all right, I think we talked about this as Chris a couple months ago, but you want to be a director for hire. You did it. It didn't work. Let it go. I don't understand why you've all of a sudden, why this thing, this film has already, it's been out of the, hadn't been playing in theaters for a couple of weeks. It had come and gone. Why you all of a sudden wanted to go after the internet critics, especially these guys who have really been championing you since the mid-90s. And he says this thing that, you know, if you want to enjoy films, stop reading about films. Well, you know, Janet Maslin is one of your earliest champions. You know, don't do this. You don't want to go down this road.
And he just got Red State. He said that he's ready to do Red State, his horror film.
Yeah, he should do that. He should focus on that. And I think, and this goes to something that we've talked about on this show, and I've talked about on other things too. I don't know how good it is that directors have this direct line that maybe should focus on their work. And when they're done with that work, then go on Twitter or go on Facebook. I think it was Film School Rejects pointed out, the most important thing is what exists between the opening credits of your film and the closing credits.
Mm.
Don't worry about Twitter.
Yeah.
You don't need that.
Well, in terms of the At the Movie show.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I got on that tangent.
No. That was an interesting topic. Thank you for that. Roger Ebert still wants something on TV, some voice of movie criticism to be represented on TV. So, I mean, he wrote extensively on his blog. I haven't had a chance to read word for word yet. That he's working on producing another movie review kind of type show. So I
welcome that.
Yeah. So there will be hope, and I'm sure with Roger Ebert's name behind it, it'll pique interest. Certainly, and have some hopes of succeeding.
Oh, I think so. I welcome. I'm so glad that he's still at it, and you need him because he's very important to this. you know, we joke about it, and I think it was actually you on the show 3 years ago who said, well, we discount the thumbs up, thumbs down thing. You know, we think that trivialized it, but he always kept his integrity the whole time.
And he kind of discounted the thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah, I mean,
he just knew it was an easily digestible thing for TV,
yeah,
a device for
exactly.
TV.
Exactly. He understood the medium, I think, better than a lot of other people did.
Yeah.
I think he and Siskel really understood what you needed to do to make a movie review show work on TV.
Mm-hmm. And they were the first. I mean, this was untreaded ground here. And I remember the copycats coming up. You know, there was
mm-hmm.
the sneak previews on public television.
Well,
so Bill Harris, like some like really really furry mustache, Bill Harris,
yeah.
I think was his
name.
No,
it was what happened was I remember I used to watch Siskel and Ebert when it was sneak previews on PBS, and then it moved
right.
to syndication, and they got Jeffrey Lyons and Michael Medved, or I think it was Jeffrey Lyons
uh-huh.
and Neil Gabler, were the first to take over on PBS. And then Michael Medved came in. But this is long before everyone knew that Michael Medved was a right-wing nut job. This is a good 10, 15 years. I know. Hey, you did not know that back then. You would
right.
never have guessed that what happened in the first decade of the 21st century, you would I never would have guessed that. When I started reading those editorials in the Wall Street Journal, I was like, is this the same guy from sneak previews? I mean,
right.
it was mind-blowing. But no. Siskel and Ebert did it first, and when they moved to syndication after PBS, they still did it, and they did it very well, and they had very thoughtful shows. They would do great shows on Spielberg, Lucas, Schwarzenegger. They did a great thing on Schwarzenegger before Terminator 2 came out. They did these really awesome shows, and, you know, it's sad. But, you know, this is not a dig at Roper at all, because I do like Richard Roper, but when Siskel passed away, that show lost something.
Yeah.
I don't mean that as a slight.
Well, I mean, it fed upon, more than anything, it fed upon the chemistry between Siskel and Ebert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that cannot be manufactured. And I don't think among film critics,
mm-hmm.
writers typically, I mean, they aren't known for their personalities in front of a camera, you know, they sit in front of a typewriter and they sit in a darkened theater and watch movies all day.
Mm-hmm.
You can't guarantee a chemistry or an exciting back and forth, an energetic back and forth.
Right.
Just putting two schmoes up there that write for newspapers. That's what made Siskel and Ebert made Siskel and Ebert work.
Right. Exactly.
Well. You know. Is Chloe or Greenberg near you? Have you seen?
I have seen Chloe.
You have seen Chloe.
All right. Okay. What do you want me to say about Chloe?
Well,
we had that wonderful composer, very nice gentleman, who put up with me and all the things I had to say. Michael Dana. He was so nice to me.
Right.
I mean, he would have to go as the most patient guest. I mean, if we had to put someone, he tolerated Jerry Dennis. Okay. Yes. But. The score is beautiful. I'll say that. It's a good film. No, it's a good film, but you do have to wonder why did they get – it's a beautiful film. I will say it's beautiful. Why did they get Adam Egan to do this? That's what I don't get. I've been reading some comments on a lot of different places lately on the last 2 days. It's because of the search for truth, and we know that Adam is very obsessed with the search for truth in all of his films. That goes back
right.
to the earliest film. But there's something almost run-of-the-mill about it. I hate to say that. And it's a great cast. And I know they want Amanda to, like, branch out to an adult role. It's definitely the antithesis of Dear John. And I have not seen Dear John, regardless of what people have said about me. I have not seen Dear John. I'd like to, but I haven't.
So you're saying that it's like hiring Adam Egoyan to do Basic Instinct?
Yeah.
To do something Paul
like
Verhoeven would do.
Yeah, it is like that. A lot of people have written it off as just schlock, and I could see that, but you got this great cast. You have Liam Neeson, Julianne Moore, God, Toronto is a beautiful city. I kept saying that throughout the movie. I was like, God.
Now, was it set in Toronto?
In Toronto. It is.
It's finally a movie that isn't using Toronto to double for something else.
Yeah, no, it is Toronto because they actually, because I was curious about that because it is Adam's film and he's Canadian, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they
yeah.
actually do, in one, and actually a scene early on in Julianne Moore, she's a very successful physician, and there's a framed photo of her family in a newspaper, a magazine article, like Toronto's most successful power couples or whatever. Liam Neeson plays a professor who is a university professor of, I want to say, music in New York City, so maybe NYU, Columbia. Very well-to-do family, beautiful house. The house is a big part of the film. So,
like a Nancy Meyers movie.
Excuse me?
Like a Nancy Meyers movie.
Like a Nancy Meyers movie. Exactly. You knew I was, you said you took the words right out of my mouth. It's hard because we talked about another one of Adam's films. During the summer, Adoration, which is
right.
I think a far greater use of his talents than this one.
Yeah.
But you're never bored during one of his films.
Okay. So you haven't seen Green Book?
I've seen Green Book. We don't have we don't have that time to talk about the movie. Let me just say this, and we'll talk about it maybe next week or when you've had a chance. Why don't we talk about it when you and Chris have seen it, or at least when you've seen it?
Just tell me if it met your expectations.
It's like looking in the mirror.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say.
So you liked it because I know how much you love looking in the mirror.
I don't like looking in the mirror, but let's just say, when I told people earlier, they're like, what are you talking about? You're nothing like him. But my perception of myself is I identify with not just him, but a great chunk of this movie. I actually do think it's a very well-done movie, and I will say this about the movie. Let me throw this out there because it was Glenn Kenny's review I read a couple weeks ago. And he said to watch The Long Goodbye. And I went back and watched The Long Goodbye last night, and I do see similarities. What Glenn's talking about in his review. And
a quintessential LA film.
An essential LA film, but there's one particular subplot of Greenberg that through what Glenn is talking about, mirrors The Long Goodbye. And I specifically moved it up on my queue. I hadn't watched it in years.
Right.
I wanted to, and this made me move it up, and I watched it last night, and it's a really brilliant observation by Kenny. Brilliant observation. I'm watching it, and I'm like, the cinematography alone, on the opening scene of Greenberg, I love. I mean, I love the opening scene of Greenberg.
Mm-hmm. Great cinematographer.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, but I like Greenberg. I'm willing to put myself on the limb and say it's incredible, but it comes with that same thing with Margot at the Wedding.
Uh-huh.
Because when I did the show with Aaron, at that point I thought it was like sort of the direct sequel to Kicking and Screaming.
Right.
I'm so wrong about that. So very wrong. Maybe the Eric Stoltz character, but even in the Eric Stoltz character, at that point in Noah Baumbach's career, his characters are not mean. They're not malevolent. They're not like Margot.
Yeah.
Well, this is like could be Margot's husband. Greenberg could be Margot's husband at this point. He's a mean SOB.
Well, I will. Yeah, I will definitely check it out so we can have more dialogue about
it. Yeah, I don't want to. I just will say this. You know, Ben Stiller, a lot of people give him a hard time. You know, we have, too. I do think it's his best role since Permanent Midnight. I actually think it's one of his best roles since Flirting with Disaster because he's really allowed to be, he can escape that the Heartbreak Kid or The Night at the Museum. And I don't have a problem with those films, but he is allowed. It's as though Noah Baumbach writes these parts for whether it be Jeff Daniels or Laura Linney or for Nicole Kidman. And they're these monstrous parts, but they're the best roles, I think, of these actors' careers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say that about Greenberg. And I know Greenberg has rubbed some people, some critics, especially the wrong way, but it just represents real life to me. At least to me, it represents, like, reality.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get into more of it, I guess, next week if it
comes
here.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, no, I look.
I know it's
to
only
hearing.
Playing at 160 screens right now.
Yeah.
It's a platform release, so they're trying to get that word of mouth going.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Cop Out earlier. Do you know that Tracy Morgan actually just signed on for his first dramatic role?
And what would that be? No, I don't mean that in a derogatory way. What would that be? What would the...
It's the new Pacino movie, Son of No One.
Wow.
I think he's playing a cop or something, or something like that. So we're going to see if he can, if he's got it. And a lot of comedians do. It's just, it's very difficult to picture him in a, maybe it's just me, but I have no doubts that he can surprise us because...
No, I have no doubts about that. What surprised me most about Cop Out is the opening scene where Tracy Morgan is making fun of acting out all those cop movies in that interrogation scene is how unfunny it is.
Right.
And he's very funny. He's very good on 30 Rock. I don't think anyone would dispute that. But I think what was really troublesome about Cop Out is how unfunny. You took all these actors, and they're not funny. And you have this knack for writing funny dialogue. And I can't believe he didn't go back and say, well, try to rewrite the script or something. I don't know. Maybe he did, and it's even worse than we thought.
Last week's, before we get into the interview, the last prelude to the interview here.
Okay, sorry.
Last week's mystery movie score. Have you any remembrance of this at all?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Let's hear a little piece of it. Any guesses in our chat room?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the chat room and take a look at what happened. No one's even talking about it.
Just a minute, maybe it'll all become clear right now.
Well, I know what it is. I think Michelle beat me too, but I...
Yeah. All right, Jerry, what is it?
Well, Michelle says Last of the Mohicans. Let's go with her. But, yeah, that's what it is. Maybe I should, you know, the lesson learned is maybe I should listen longer.
That's what it is. Last of the Mohicans was our mystery movie score last week. And what will it be this week? Find out at the conclusion of the show. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wow. Okay, let's get to this. let's get to this interview. Handsome Harry. This is a great, great movie. Let me bring up my screen. I can read to you what it's about.
Please do, because I'm very curious.
First of all, Jamie Sheridan, actor Jamie Sheridan. He's been in the business a long time. Movies like Syriana and Nothing But the Truth and The Ice Storm, and
right.
He does a lot of stage work. I first became aware of him. In Whispers in the Dark, remember that movie, early
yes,
90s?
Yes, I do. Isn't that Annabella Soror and Alan Alda?
Right. And
I know that is embarrassing, but okay.
Oddly enough, the thing that made me aware of it was the fact that he's another Jamie who spells his name like I spell mine.
There you go.
And which was the first thing that we said to each other yesterday. He was like, it's great to meet another guy named Jamie. I said, that spells their name with an E-Y. I said, we're kindred spirits, man. So we're having coffee later on. So you never know what connection, where you'll find a connection. So anyway, I always thought that was neat. But this movie is fantastic. It's called Handsome Harry. And it tells the story of an ex-Navy man who carries out the last wish of a dying shipmate and faces demons of his past that still haunt and imprison him in the process. The film stars, listen to this cast, Jamie, of course, Aidan Quinn, John Savage, Steve Buscemi, Campbell Scott, and each of them just give indelible impressions in this movie, especially somebody like Campbell Scott.
Yeah.
And I got to say this. There's something about Campbell Scott, because I'm watching Damages this season, too, and, of course, I've seen all of Campbell's other work, too, but if you think in terms of his father, George C. Scott,
right,
this volcanic guy, powerful actor,
mm-hmm.
Really intense, but in a way that he would express it. He wasn't opposed to expressing it through screaming.
Right.
I mean, he was a terrific actor. Campbell Scott is equally intense, but in a very different way. His intensity, his power is in his stillness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just great acting. I mean,
right? No, and it's there in Roger Dodger for
mm-hmm.
sure. I like that
mm-hmm.
movie a lot. I know a lot of people.
I do too.
And it's there. I mean, it's there in all the movies that he's been in. A movie that I love a lot. We were talking about earlier. My mom and I is The Secret Lives of Dentists. The last
yes,
Rudolph,
it's a great movie. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Burdened with a not really a terrible title. I mean, but it's not a movie that.
It's not the first thing you think of. That's not the title you think of when
yeah.
But
yeah.
he's just and you know he's puts in these performances. He's a very good director too, and he's someone I wish we'd see more of.
Mm-hmm.
But I love both of those movies a lot, and now I definitely want to check this one out.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, back to the movie. Sorry for that little
excursion.
The movie is directed by Bette Gordon, and it opens in limited release on April 16th, and we had the pleasure of welcoming Bette and Jamie Sheridan to discuss their engrossing and intensely moving film. Here is the interview for Handsome Harry. Let me tell you, first of all, I really adored your movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fantastic, and I understood
you.
It came to you in a kind of unusual way through a student of yours, the script?
No, actually, somebody that I've worked with for a number of years. He's a screenwriter and a director. He's done a lot. He used to work with Maisels and, you know, has a kind of interesting background. He had given me the script to read simply, you know, to give him notes, and I fell in love immediately and couldn't get it out of my head. So it was one of those kind of meant to be. You know, you don't know what's going to happen until it happens, and then it does, and it's a love at first sight, which I think was the same for Jamie when I gave it to him. Right, Jamie?
Yeah. First time I read it, I couldn't sleep.
Yeah, we just, both of us
had
like...
trying to produce something of my own. Betty and I were sort of hanging out, kvetching to each other in New York, you know, what are you trying to do? Well, I'm not getting anything done, and well, I'm not getting anything done. She gave me this script,
We
have to do this come hell or high water, you know?
Yeah, and it just fell into my lap. I mean, it was a friend asking another friend to give, you know, some feedback. And when I, you know, went on and on about how much I loved the story and I couldn't get out of my head, he said, well, why don't you direct it? And it was sort of a gift, you know, it was a beautiful
mm-hmm.
gift. And the whole thing has been rather magical. I mean, everybody that's worked with us, and especially for Jamie and I together, because we wanted to work together again, and just all the people that came on board have been incredible.
I was seducing her, Jamie. I was seduced for at least 2 years.
let me hear from both of you guys, starting with you, Betty. If you could tell me, upon that reading of the script, that you couldn't get it out of your head, what were those themes? What was it speaking to that spoke to you?
The sort of central idea in this case, a man who was hiding and living a lie, somebody who had a secret, and that, you know, you can live with that for just so long, but eventually the past and those secrets are going to catch up with you. So in some ways, I've always responded to a search for the truth. I think it's something that I've done in my own life, and, you know, at every juncture, you know, whether you be 18 or 25 or 35 or 65, you know, there's this sort of sense of trying to face the things of your life. And I think that's what attracted me. The question of identity and sexuality are questions that I've dealt with in my other work. So I really, you know, responded to those. Although women have often been the subject of my earlier work, this seemed a perfect companion to looking at male sexuality in the same way. And I think you have to, if you're really going to study gender and sexuality, which I have over the course of some of my films, I think you have to look at it from both sides. And so I was just very attracted to that. And, of course, to Harry himself, who I found a very compelling character, somebody whose search, once he opens up the idea of being drawn to the light, even with the pain, no matter how great the pain, like Oedipus, he can't stop looking and searching. And I think it's an experience that I wanted people to have. You know, I wanted audiences to just plug into that search.
And so, Jamie, when you read it, as an actor, you're reading a piece of material. What criteria did it meet for you, both in terms of character and story?
That first night, one of the images that was in my head very quickly was, it's an odd thing, but it was a film noir to me, and I kept seeing Lee Marvin in Point Blank for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with the structure of the story peeling layers back one after another.
Right.
And this guy setting out down the road for the truth, looking for the truth.
Yeah.
And, and Point Blank is simple payback, as Mel Gibson named it when he did it.
Mm-hmm.
But payback is what Harry ultimately is looking for, and payback is ultimately what he needs and tries to get.
Right.
Retribution. And ultimately, the executioner, or the one who applies the retribution, is himself, which that's the thing that he demands. That's why the end was so compelling for me. That we did a lot of work on the ending, trying to get it right, and I think we did pretty well with it, where he wants more than anything, now that he's found his true love, really, to just walk into that embrace and go home together. And he can't allow that, because he, like Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, he needs his punishment. He needs to be punished.
Yeah.
And that little shake of the head, I can't come, I can't come, I can't come now, maybe, is what he's thinking. Who knows? But the audience, I like that we left it for the audience to decide what happens, 5 years down the line.
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned somebody like Lee Marvin, because I think this movie also speaks to this kind of philosophy of machismo, of what, what a man is supposed to be, what he feels he should be himself, that role. And Betty, you were talking about male stereotypes too. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit upon that aspect of the script.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also, when I read the script, I immediately saw those characters as being portrayed by some of the great movie actors who I have been drawn to my whole, sort of adult life of watching movies. For example, people like Lee Marvin, Ben Gazzara, Steve McQueen. The idea of a rawness, a physicality that somehow masks a very strong inner life. And I think all of these guys are a product of that time period, of that generation. And, there's something very attractive, too, about, that kind of masculinity, but also something very painful about it. And so, I think, look at Cassavetes' Husbands, which was a movie that I studied, many times over when we were making this film, too, to really look at those sort of codes of behavior and what does that mean. And for a woman to look at that, because, we're excluded from those codes. So I wanted to get close. I wanted to touch and feel and smell. I was interested in the, the kind of texture of what that's about, as is Cassavetes, certainly, but his is an insider view. I wanted my slightly outsider view to kind of inform, I think, an even greater sense of vulnerability, which is something that, you have a little inkling of when you see those male actors, William Holden and in Best Years of Our Lives, which is another prime example. But you don't quite, I wanted to inhabit that space, that, sort of masculine physical space, and that's what I was looking for, faces, voices, gestures, the subtlety of that.
Well, you guys, you mentioned that you guys have worked together before in recent years. And so I'm going to give you guys an opportunity to flatter each other, or not. tell me what you get from this collaboration, Jamie, if you want to start out here.
Well, yeah, the reason I was working on Betty, that I wanted to work with Betty again, was the first time we worked together, I had been, and actually over probably over 20 years of making movies, or 25 years of making movies, I've often felt kind of hemmed in and sort of facing expectations when I was about to work and struggling to kind of break free, to kind of struggling to get really loose and instinctive in my work. And when I worked with Betty, every time that I took a risk, I turn around, she'd be standing there smiling and clapping her hands. And she wouldn't say anything. And I'd go, well, and she'd say, let's do it again. And I'd go, why? And she'd go, let's see how far you go this time. And she really just kept opening doors for me, and saying, run through them. Just run through them, and, you know, it's only film. Which, the part is not, it's not the lead part in that movie, but it's a good part that I was very happy with, and I, the performance was one that I was happy with, and I thought, I should work like that. It may be my problem that I am not always as loose as I'd like to be, but I knew that with Betty, that we'd struggle with each other, we'd argue and everything like that, but her challenge would always be to go further, to get looser, to be more relaxed, to throw different colors on the wall and see what they look like. And I knew that, and so when Harry came up, I just thought, this is going to be great. I had no idea how far it would go, but I knew that we would work gracefully together.
And so, Betty, how about you from your end? What about Jamie attracted you, especially for this part?
In the Luminous Motion audition that he did, well, I also saw him do a Sam Shepard piece. Remember that at the Public when you did that Sam Shepard piece? Yeah, I stood up in my chair at the end and I said, who is that? I need to know him. I need to work with him. So then he came in for my audition, and he was the first person I saw for that role, and no one else ever compared. I mean, that, you know, I fell in love at that moment, and there was no other person who came in who could ever, whoever got the nuance of that character. Yeah. And what I loved is that the guy was written a bit cliche on the page. I'm not even talking about Harry now. I'm talking about Luminous Motion. He was written a little bit sort of one-dimensional, and what Jamie did was he turned his asset, his strength, and his need for control into a vulnerability, and I love that. I thought, God, it was just a brilliant way of conceiving this guy who just wanted to control everything, and instead of making him a control freak, allowed the weakness to show. So I knew that you know, we would go in some direction with Harry that had something to do with that, and I loved all of the time that it actually did take us to get the movie together, because it gave me and Jamie chances to have hours of discussion about who is Harry and, you know, what's Harry's life like, and we would act things out for each other. Remember, we'd meet in bars and we'd just read the script and we'd go to each other's houses and we'd, you know, what I love is process, and clearly Jamie does too. So whether it's on the set, process is always important, or, you know, before we get to the set or even after. Just that sense of, you know, working something through over and over again is fascinating to me.
Speaking of process, as an actor, Jamie, do you ever feel, take Handsome Harry, for instance, do you ever feel like there's a moment when you think, yes, I have this character, or are you constantly reaching and trying to figure it out during the duration of the shoot?
I'm still trying to figure it out. I have to admit, though, but once the film's finished, I look at it and go, oh, there he is, and he's a little bit walking over a hill, but there's a part of me that's thinking of things I could have done, still sort of dreaming his dreams. I don't think I settle at all, ever, really. It's I must say, when the editor comes up with a very good cut, then I see the thoughts organized. And I remember when this, you know, we had one cut that was an early cut, and everybody warned me it's an early cut. There was one cut where all of a sudden it was like, wow, there's the story. And I saw the story line up. And then I was pretty satisfied with Harry. You know, I knew that I had felt a lot of things and done a lot of things and held back a lot of things. And I knew where I wanted them to be. And then all of a sudden they were in a cut. And I thought, okay, there's the story. There it is. So there was a bit of a change of gear there as far as some satisfaction with what had been done.
Yeah.
But the engine of creation, that doesn't really stop. Pretty obsessive, you know.
But you are surrounded. You're fantastic in this movie, and you're surrounded by just the most amazing group of actors. Tell me about that process, Betty, in assembling that cast. This must have been the dream cast for you.
Yes, it was. But Jamie and I worked together on this, too. We would, you know, we would come up with ideas of people whose work we loved or people that he had worked with before. I mean, we were very, you know, this sort of the detail of what somebody's, you know, kind of mannerisms or face or ability to kind of bring that out. The physicality, I mean, that was a very big thing for us. So we really were going after certain people, and, you know, some of it changed as we went along, depending upon availability. But we did
Betty
so much
wanted,
of it together.
Betty wanted Ben Gazzara and Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. And I got to tell you something. When I said that at the Tribeca Film Festival about physicality and rawness and appeal, Steve Buscemi was there. And usually people don't see him like that. You know, he's sort of usually seen as, what did he say, like the Barney Rubble or like the you know, the kind of goofy guy. So he was so appreciative that I saw him like that, you know, because he is an incredibly physical actor who people often see in a kind of almost like a head without a body. I wanted to see him more sort of in his whole body, even though dying, you know, the whole idea of giving up the corporeal, you know, and what that meant to him. And he was, you know, he was great at bringing in suggestions and et cetera. So, yeah, it was a dream cast, and I loved every minute with every single one of them. It was, they were all fantastic.
And even
people like Bill Sage, who I had worked with before, and so had Jamie. We loved him for the Polly character, you know, the guy who Harry works with, or Jane. Wanted her. Yeah, Atkinson, and I had fallen in love with her in the scenes with Jamie and Syriana, and we went after, you know, and people responded to the material. That's the good news. Is that an actor given really good material that they can sink their teeth into is you know, not always, doesn't always happen, so that because we knew we had something, we could go after the people we wanted.
Well, it's interesting because Jamie, you share two scenes with most of these fellow cast members.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a period where you guys have to kind of find your footing and your chemistry together? Or did you find that easy? What was that process like for you?
I would say, I think it took a little bit in the shooting. With Campbell and I have worked together 3 or 4 times now.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie benefits a lot from that. We know each other very well, and we're able to sort of play new kinds of music pretty quickly. With everybody else, there was a feeling out process, I think, but it had to happen quick because
we
shot the movie in 18 days. So,
but
it had
sometimes
to happen quick. But everybody was prepared and everybody was ready, and I had talked to everybody on the phone, and we got to visit with Steve one morning. I didn't get to see Aiden before he came, but I actually kind of liked that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about these people were I actually imagined specific people that I knew when I was 19. And it allowed me to walk in and meet Aiden Quinn, to walk in and meet Steve Buscemi and stuff like that, as if I hadn't seen them in 30 years, and that helped me. So
yeah.
The strangeness of people, I basically used the strangeness of everybody. John Savage. That felt appropriately edgy for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, yep.
And I wanted to keep it that way.
I didn't talk
to John much until we were about halfway through that day.
Yeah.
And I became very grateful and talked to him about his great work that I admired so much. But I didn't want to do that before the day was about half gone because I wanted us to be bristling at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
This is also a question about process. In terms of, you guys have both been doing this for a long time now, and Betty, I know you've been making movies since the 70s and the independent movement and Variety. I think that was back in 83, wasn't it?
Yeah, 83, 84. Yeah, it came out in 84, yeah, and I shot it in 82 and 83, yes.
And I'm wondering, does it get, not necessarily easier, but do you become more adept at certain things that the process kind of streamlines for you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, being able to work over time is a really lovely thing because you also have the benefit of your life experience as you know, when you start off as a filmmaker, you wonder, well, what do I really have to say? What life have I lived? You know, what have I been through? You know, what pains, what joys, what struggles. And so as your life, you know, sort of goes on, you begin to face more of the kinds of issues that you're hopefully dealing with in your films. So in that case, it's easier. I mean, I would say every time I'm on set, I wish I could even do more. But it takes so much effort to raise the financing in between every film that you live with an idea for a long time. And, you know, in a way, that's a good thing. Because you have to be really committed to what your idea is, because so many people will say no before they say yes, and so you can't ever be daunted by that. It's about passion, and I think the older you get, maybe the more passionate you get. I don't know.
Right.
But also there's a lot of time in between films where, you know, I'm expressing, I've worked in TV a little bit, and also I teach, I mentor a lot of younger directors, so that muscle of trying to find a way of bringing something alive off the page and onto the screen is just a great exercise for me, even when it's not my own, but I'm pushing people in that direction.
Yeah. And Jamie, with performance, the actors that I've spoken to in the past, I think one of them expressed that the difference between them now and 30 years ago when they started acting is that they've kind of streamlined their process and they don't feel the need to throw in everything but the kitchen sink in preparation for a role. How has the process morphed for you over the years?
Well, I think I've learned how to say more with less,
mm-hmm.
Just in terms of, playing a lot of roles, an awful lot of roles, 26, 7 movies and a lot of stuff. I've learned to subtract. Probably the most valuable thing I have to say, though, Betty touched on it, is passion. I having a movie like this where no one's going to mess with us,
mm-hmm.
and because there's almost no money at stake, no one wants to mess with you. And the passion is, I don't have the patience. I'm not going to waste any time. I'm not going to have the patience for anything except full commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think of so many times when I care deeply about a role and I'm trying and working very, very hard to get deeper and deeper inside the role. Here's one where I arrived on the set with 4 years of work on it ready. And I just felt quiet and focused and ready to work. And I really did not want to talk about anything except the work.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to play. I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to get to work, and every instant had to be focused on the job. And I think after 30 years of doing it, I was willing to defend that space. I was willing to say, leave me alone. I was willing to say, I was willing to risk being maybe not the friendliest guy on stage. And I'm a pretty friendly guy, so I'm not saying I was doing anything terrible, but I think I wanted to be liked more before. And with Harry, all I wanted was to get to the heart of it. And I was willing to sacrifice anything and everything else.
Well, you did that. I mean, that this is a great performance and a great movie. And before I let you go, you both can speak to this. It's such a long process, and Jamie, you mentioned 4 years of you guys putting this together. So when you screen the movie, when you finally release this child onto the world, and you watch it with an audience, how does that experience of this film that you're so intimately connected with change or deepen for you once it gets out there to an audience?
Can I go first, Betty?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been doing the festivals in the West. I've been the Western guy here, so I've been to all these festivals in the West. And watching audiences react to this movie, go completely silent, and the things they go through has been so exciting and satisfying for me. It's a little like watching a great piece of music I shouldn't use that word, a good piece of music being played, and people's attention, you know, focusing, and you hear this, you can hear the silence, and you can hear some sobbing, and it's been a tremendous experience to watch the audience react, and it's strengthened my. It's forced me out to want to talk about the movie with people, because when I saw people react as well as they have, it forced me. I started really enjoying Q&As, the question and answer sessions, and feeling a lot for my audience. It made me feel great about the audience, and it's easy to fear the audience when you're trying to sell them something and you don't know if it's going to be good.
In this case, I've sort of
fallen in love with the audience.
That's the benefit of a film festival, too, because I know that you do a lot of stage work, and it's obvious that that's an automatic reaction, but you rarely get that from film, so I would think that would be a very special thing for you.
Yeah. And especially in combination with making a film, which is such a quiet, private, especially a movie like this, which is very much the direction I want to take my film career, something this quiet and focused has nothing in the world to do with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Then to give that little precious little thing to people, then it's better than being on stage.
Yeah.
Because it's so tiny and so small and so vulnerable. And you go into the dark room and people come out with a reaction and you feel like you've actually touched somebody, and it's pretty great.
I think I grew up in the cinemas, so for me, there's nothing like the cinematic experience of being, first of all, it's the moment before the film starts that I love the best, which is a sort of hushed feeling of the audience as the lights go out and, you know, the first image, which is bigger than life, comes up onto the screen, because it's that magnification that I'm so drawn to. It's the, you know, the kind of darkened room and the dreamlike atmosphere of being, sharing this experience with an audience of people that you don't know. So it's a common experience that you know, definitely is seductive. It's, for me, cinema is all about seduction. And so watching the movie with an audience is like, you know, the first phases of, you know, falling in love or not, and when you feel the audience coming around and really being with you and with the film, it's such a great, amazing experience. And then when you see them laugh in a place that you didn't necessarily know they were going to laugh at, or, you know, that first line where Karen Young says, how about a birthday blowjob, and he doesn't respond exactly the way that people would expect him to, and there's a sense of laughter and nervous laughter, and you know, at that moment, you know, yeah, okay, you know, like, all right, they're going to take the ride with us. And, you know, there are little moments like that all the way through. And as Jamie said, especially the silences and the you know, the emotive moments where you could hear a pin drop. So watching a movie in a movie theater will never, ever, ever lose its power for me. I don't care how much digital everything and 3D everything there is out into the world. Wherever there's a small cinema, if I have to go all the way to Paris, I'll go there, because the group experience in a darkened theater with a kind of magnified image of bodies and faces on the screen will always carry a big power for me.
Yeah, I hope we never lose that shared experience.
Well, I think we're in danger of it, you know, and the more I hear about young people talking about internet, you know, can you imagine having your movie screened on the internet for the first time? You're not even there.
Yeah.
So what is that going to be like, you know, in 5 years when, you know, it's all about a virtual movie that's something that nobody shares except you in front of your computer with 20 other things going on at the same time.
Yeah,
wow.
I'm with you. I'm completely with you on that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you guys, let me just thank you both for making this film. I was very moved by it, and I wish you the very best of luck with it.
We love talking to you, and I wish we could talk for like another hour because, you know, being asked good questions is really an important part of thinking about the work that you've done, and it's nice to share that with you.
Well, let's
it's
do
all
it
part
again.
Of the process. Let's do it again, yeah. I love this part of the process, too, because we get to think about what we've done in a new way, and that's great.
Yeah.
So
thank you. Thank you
very simpatico, Jamie. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye
now. All right,
now.
Jamie.
Okay, Bette Gordon and actor Jamie Sheridan from the new film Handsome Harry, opening April 16th.
It sounds really good. It sounds very fascinating.
It's a surprising movie, how it kind of creeps up on you. So.
Cool.
All right, Jerry, is there any, well, I guess we should reveal what's coming up. Wednesday, we're continuing the new classic series with an in-depth examination of Seven, David Fincher's Seven, during which we'll be featured a little interview with one of that film's producers.
Cool.
And talking about, you know, how the movie... turns the genre on its head.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. So we'll be discussing that in terms of story, in terms of style, the look of the movie, and the performances. And it'll be a great coverage of that film that so many people are fond of. And then we're booking guests as we speak, so we'll know more about next Sunday's show. But included in those guests will be actor Stephen Root. Who we know from Office Space and No Country for Old Men, and he just died on 24 last week.
Wow. So, hey, what do you think about that? The 24 is basically no more.
24 is no more.
I know. I didn't mean that to be a poem. no, I haven't, and I feel really bad because I haven't really kept up with it this season, but I hear this season is awesome.
The season's pretty good. I mean, it started out very... very much a groaner, how much can I buy? But but it's shaped up into something pretty intense. There's a couple of thoughts I have on it. First of all, they want to make a movie, so Kiefer Sutherland and the show creators actually welcomed the show ending.
Right.
But the power of the show has always been in the element of surprise. So it ending and the promise of a feature film, you know, Jack Bauer's not going to die. And Kiefer Sutherland's actually always said that. He said, I'd kind of really like the idea of killing Jack Bauer off, like, halfway through one of the seasons, which would be an incredibly ballsy thing to do. And this is a show that has done some incredibly ballsy things.
No, it has. You're absolutely right.
And its influence is pretty massive, too.
Yeah.
So it's got a legacy. So this will be its last season. It'll go out the same way that the movies went out.
Oh, God.
I'm sure that Kiefer Sutherland's last line will be, we'll save you the aisle seat.
All right.
Let's get back to you guys on Wednesday night. I thank you all for joining us tonight.
Yes, thank you.
Jerry, thank you.
Thank you. We got a mystery movie score, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We do have a mystery movie score.
You're
ready for it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, let's see how quick you are in the draw in the chat room with your competitors in there.
Okay.
This actually is a score that was copied from another score.
Oh, shit. Okay. That really doesn't help things, Jamie. At all.
So that's the only hint you guys are going to get.
Thank you so much.
Might be pretty obvious.
Okay.
All right, guys. See you next time.
All right. Good night.
Thank you.